Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. This is Democracy Now! Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as Hamas military commander Mohammed Deif. We'll get the latest, then go to Washington, where the U.S. Senate has rejected a motion by Senator Bernie Sanders to block some arms sales to Israel.
What this extremist government has done in Gaza is unspeakable. But what makes it even more painful is that much of this has been done with U.S. weapons and American taxpayer dollars.
We will also get the latest from the UN Climate Summit, where civil society just unfurled the names of Palestinians at a people's plenary who have been killed. They prayed for the dead. This comes as calls mount for wealthy, polluting nations to pay more for their role in causing the climate crisis. Speak to the chair of the African Group of Negotiators, as well as a top Indian climate activist and a leading climate correspondent for The Guardian. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Criminal Court has just issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity and war crimes committed during Israel's assault on Gaza. In a statement, the ICC said the Israeli leaders had, quote, intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival, including food, water, and medicine and medical supplies, as well as fuel and electricity. The ICC also issued an arrest warrant for Hamas military commander Mohammed Deif, though Israel's military claims it killed him in a July airstrike. Here in the United States, 19 senators Wednesday voted against sending Israel more offensive weapons over Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its gross human rights violations. Though the joint resolutions of disapproval introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders failed to pass, it was the largest such rebuke of U.S. policy of unconditional military support for Israel. We'll have more on the Senate vote after headlines. The vote came as Israel continues its slaughter in Gaza, killing at least 88 Palestinians over the past day in attacks on Beit Lahia and the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City. Israeli forces are continuing to attack the occupied West Bank with deadly raids in Jenin, as well as assaults in Hebron, Ramallah, and elsewhere. Illegal Jewish settlers on Wednesday attacked the Palestinian town of Al-Masra, Al-Qibleya, near Ramallah, setting cars ablaze. This is Hilda Sanduka, a Palestinian mother who survived the attack.
We were afraid and terrified. My daughters started to scream and cry. Thank God that they only burnt the vehicles. They could have set fire inside the house while we were sleeping. We are far away from the downtown. If something happens here, they may not help us. Thank God neighbors helped out.
Meanwhile, Syria's state media reports Israeli attacks killed 36 people in Palmyra. At least 9 people were killed by Israel in the Lebanese city of Tyre. Hezbollah's leader, Naim Qassem, says he's reviewed a U.S.-led ceasefire proposal and told negotiators the group rejects language allowing Israel to breach Lebanese sovereignty by attacking within its borders. At the UN Security Council in New York, the U.S. Wednesday vetoed its fourth ceasefire resolution since Israel began its war on Gaza over 18 months ago. The 14 other members of the UN Security Council voted in favor. China's UN ambassador, Fu Hong, slammed the U.S. veto.
The U.S.'s long use of the veto has dashed the hopes of the people of Gaza for survival, pushing them further into darkness and desperation. I said during the Council's debate on Monday that every moment will be recorded in history and will be judged by history.
Palestine's deputy UN envoy Majid Bamia also addressed the UN Security Council, condemning the U.S. veto, for which he said there is no justification.
There is no right to mass killing of civilians. There is no right to starve an entire civilian population. There is no right to forcibly displace a people. And there is no right to annexation. This is what Israel is doing in Gaza. These are its war objectives. This is what the absence of a ceasefire is allowing it to continue doing.
This ceasefire resolution was introduced after 13 months of Israel's war on Gaza. Ukraine's Air Force says Russia has used an intercontinental ballistic missile for the first time in an attack this morning on the Ukrainian city of Dnipro. The missile was reportedly launched from Russia's Astrakhan region near the Caspian Sea, part of a wave of missile attacks overnight that killed at least three people and wounded 22 others. Meanwhile, Russia said its air defense system shot down a pair of long-range Storm Shadow missiles fired by Ukraine. It's the first time British weapons have been used by Ukraine in an attack on Russian soil, coming a day after Ukraine fired U.S.-made TACMs into Russia for the first time. Here at the COP29 climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, divisions remain deep as a draft of a climate finance deal was met with overwhelming disapproval. Among the major issues is the absence of a firm number in the draft text. Poorer nations bearing the brunt of the climate crisis say at least $1.3 trillion a year is needed. We'll have the latest later in the broadcast. On Wednesday, delegates from Ukraine and Palestine shared the devastating impact of war on the climate. Ukraine's environment minister, Svetlana Grinchuk, says Russia's invasion has come at a cost of $71 billion in environmental destruction.
The war already impacted 3 million hectares of Ukrainian forests. Due to the ongoing forest fires caused by Russian military actions, the greenhouse gas absorption potential of Ukrainian forest has decreased by 1.7 million tons of CO2. Nature knows no borders, so it will have negative impact on the neighbor countries and on food supply chain around the world.
Haitian authorities say 28 suspected gang members were killed Tuesday when armed vigilantes joined state security forces to thwart an attack on an upscale suburb of Port-au-Prince. The bodies of the alleged gang members were decapitated and burned in the streets. It's part of an escalating wave of violence that spread across Haiti's capital, where the International Organization for Migration reports some 20,000 people have been displaced from their homes over the weekend. This is the UN's Ulrika Richardson.
We have seen over the past few days increased in terms of killings and lynching on part of the armed gangs. We have increasing and very steep humanitarian needs. This is already people who live, many populations who live in a very, very tough living conditions. And the situation by day is deteriorating.
On Tuesday, the medical aid charity Doctors Without Borders said it suspended most of its operations in Port-au-Prince following threats by Haitian police and an attack on one of its ambulances. Brazil and China agreed to, quote, elevate their global strategic partnership as the two countries signed 37 trade and development deals Wednesday during Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit in Brasilia. This is the Brazilian President, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
Defendemos We advocate the reform of global governance and a more democratic, fair, equitable, and environmentally sustainable international system. In a world plagued by armed conflicts and geopolitical tensions, China and Brazil put peace, diplomacy, and dialogue first.
In other news from Brazil, five people were arrested, including an advisor to former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, over an alleged plot to assassinate then-president-elect Lula in 2022. In Greece, thousands of workers poured onto the streets of major cities as part of a 24-hour general strike that brought the shipping industry, schools, and other industries to a halt Wednesday. Public sector unions are demanding a 10% pay increase amidst a worsening housing and cost of living crisis.
We demand collective conventions, higher wages, and overall a policy that aims to cover people's basic needs and not boost the profits of big capital.
President-elect Donald Trump has chosen Matthew Whitaker to be U.S. ambassador to NATO. Whitaker was acting attorney general during Trump's first term after Trump forced Jeff Sessions to resign. During his brief tenure, Whitaker sparred with Democratic lawmakers over the constitutionality of his appointment and for repeatedly refusing to answer questions during congressional hearings. Whitaker does not have a foreign affairs background. In 2018, The Washington Post reported Whitaker was paid more than $1.2 million to lead a right-wing charity for 3 years that was funded by dark money. In more transition news, Trump will reportedly name Russ Vogt, one of the authors of Project 2025, to return as head of the Office of Management and Budget. The U.S. House is expected to vote again today on what's been dubbed the nonprofit killer bill, H.R. 9495, which could hand Trump the power to effectively shut down any nonprofit by labeling it a terrorist-supporting organization. And the Justice Department has requested a federal court order, Google, to sell its Chrome web browser to combat Google's internet search monopoly. The request from the DOJ and a group of states comes after August's landmark ruling that Google violated antitrust laws. The move could reshape how information is accessed and shared online. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. I'm Amy Goodman here with Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh.
In The Hague, the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity and war crimes committed during Israel's assault on Gaza. In a statement, the ICC said the Israeli leaders had, quote, intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival, including food, water and medicine and medical supplies, as well as fuel and electricity. The ICC also issued an arrest warrant for Hamas military commander Mohammed Deif, though Israel's military claims it killed Deif in a July airstrike. The ICC arrest warrants come a week after a UN special committee found Israel's actions in Gaza since October 2023 are, quote, consistent with genocide, including using starvation as a weapon of war and recklessly inflicting civilian casualties.
In related news, on Wednesday, the United States vetoed a Gaza ceasefire resolution at the UN Security Council for the fourth time, and the U.S. Senate rejected a resolution brought by Senator Bernie Sanders that sought to block the sale of U.S. tank rounds, bomb kits, and other lethal weapons to Israel. 19 senators supported blocking the arms. For more on all of this, we're joined by Akbar Shahed Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. His latest piece is exclusive. White House says Democrats who oppose weapons to Israel are aiding Hamas. Ahmed, thank you so much for being with us as you write your book on the Biden administration in Gaza called Crossing the Red Line. Clearly, the ICC has ruled that today by issuing arrest warrants deterrence for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Can you talk about the significance of this move?
Yeah, Amy, this is just an absolutely huge development, and it's significant for a number of reasons. It's significant because the ICC has come out and amplified and affirmed the allegations of crimes against humanity, of war crimes. This is one more international body. These are trained international judges with a great deal of respect. This is a court that most of the world is a member of. And they're coming out and saying, look, we think there are reasonable grounds to believe that these major international red lines have been crossed by the Israelis. What's really important to remember is that this isn't just a decision about Israel. By extension, it fundamentally is a decision about the United States, which has been the ultimate enabler of Israel's offensives in Gaza and Lebanon, which are under consideration by the ICC. And even in this ICC statement today, they point out that in the situations where Israel has addressed concerns over what it describes as starvation as a method of warfare, right, depriving civilians, Palestinians of food, water, medical equipment, Israel has really only done so in an extremely arbitrary and what the ICC judges call conditional way in response to the U.S. So fundamentally, Amy, what we're seeing is the ICC is saying yet again that Israel and the U.S., as its major enabler and backer, are in the dark and will continue to be in the dark for years to come. This kind of adds to a broader picture in which there are now ICC warrants for the sitting Israeli Prime Minister and former Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, who remains a significant politician in Israel. Simultaneously, there's the genocide case at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, which is ongoing and will be ongoing for years to come. And there's a Geneva Conventions conference underway next year regarding kind of similar issues, right? Violations of international law, laws of war, and these really grave abuses that are alleged. So the U.S. and Israel will be kind of on trial on the international stage for years to come.
So, Akbar, would you say that this move is mostly a symbolic one? Because as you pointed out, of course, most countries are members of the International Criminal Court. But in this instance, perhaps most importantly, neither Israel nor the U.S. are.
Right, Nermeen. So, and that's something that the ICC judges did get into today, right? Because Israel said, look, the International Criminal Court doesn't have jurisdiction over us. That said, the state of Palestine is a member of the court, and that's where this becomes a relevant and interesting thing, because you've seen European nations recognize Palestine as a state. You've seen Palestine join the United Nations General Assembly over just last year. So, yes, while the U.S. and Israel continue to reject international scrutiny by the ICC, by the ICJ, of Israel's conduct in Gaza and the occupied West Bank and Lebanon, there's a growing international push to kind of challenge that. Right, and I think you will see the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration assertively push back against the ICC. The Trump administration did actually target the ICC directly when President Trump was last in office, threatening to put sanctions on ICC officials. And we also know from reporting that the Israelis have spied on and threatened the ICC themselves, according to reporting by The Guardian. So, yes, there will be increased pressure, but I think we're really in a place that no one thought we would be even a few months ago, right? I think even the prospect of the ICC prosecutor successfully getting these warrants issued, it was initially thought that would be quite quick. It's taken a long time. The fact that judges were able to issue those warrants suggests that even though it's an uphill battle to get this international scrutiny, there's a real determination and clear will. And we've seen a lot of states turn around and say over 13 months, right, since the October 7 attack by Hamas within Israel that did spark this current round of fighting, there have been calls to say we don't want this to escalate, right? The U.S.'s allies, Western countries have said, we want to resolve this. We don't want you on trial. Can the U.S. and Israel please change course? And what you've seen is a defiance from Tel Aviv and from Washington to say, actually, no, we're continuing these wars. So that does take it to a different forum to kind of change the policy.
And Akbar, could you also, while we're looking at the way in which international organizations, multilateral ones, are responding to this, what about the latest vote at the Security Council and the fact that the U.S. blocked it for the fourth time, a ceasefire vote?
It's really striking at this point, right, to see the Biden administration totally alone. And you see the how this develops over the course of the war. Initially, the U.S. was able to get Britain, even France, kind of abstaining, standing with them. And now, 13 months in, where conduct hasn't changed, and you still have daily strikes that are killing dozens, sometimes over 100 civilians, you have a mounting death toll of mostly women and children, the U.S. is totally alone, where it's shielding Israel on the world stage diplomatically. And this is really important to see in the context of the Biden administration as an outlier, even among American presidents and administrations. When President Barack Obama was in office, after he was in the lame duck period that President Biden is in now, he actually did abstain at the United Nations Security Council and said, you know what, go ahead and pass a resolution that Israel doesn't like, because tacitly, the U.S. acknowledged there was a basis, there were credible grounds for that resolution, which in that instance was about Israeli settlement activity. Here, what you're seeing from the Biden administration, even in their dying days, right, 2 months to go, there's an obstinacy, a defiance, and a real commitment to shielding Israel, even if they are totally alone, against now their closest allies, Britain, France, and everyone else on the Security Council. So I think the context of that veto kind of presages whatever may come in the next 2 months in terms of the Biden administration allowing any UN scrutiny of the wars.
Akbar, I wanted to play Palestine's envoy to the United Nations, Majid Bamia, speaking yesterday.
There is no right to mass killing of civilians. There is no right to starve an entire civilian population. There is no right to forcibly displace a people. And there is no right to annexation. This is what Israel is doing in Gaza. Maybe for some we have the wrong nationality, the wrong faith, the wrong skin color. But we are humans, and we should be treated as such. Is there a UN charter for Israel that is different from the charter you all have? Tell us. Is there an international law for them, an international law for us? Do they have the right to kill, and the only right we have is to die?
And I want to go right over to what happened on the Senate floor. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders speaking ahead of Wednesday's Senate vote to block the sale of U.S. tank rounds, bomb kits, and other lethal weapons to Israel. The measure did fail, but 18 other senators joined Sanders to stop arming Israel.
I've heard members of the U.S. Senate come to this floor to denounce human rights violations taking place around the world. I've heard well-founded concerns about China's brutal reception of the Uyghur ethnic minority. I've heard rightful outrage about Putin's brutal attacks against Ukraine and bombing of civilian installations. I've heard genuine concern about Iran's outrageous crackdown on peaceful protesters. I've heard repeated condemnations of Saudi Arabia's terrible treatment of women and political dissidents. And on it goes. A lot of folks come to the floor to talk about human rights and what's going on around the world. But what I want to say to all those folks, nobody is going to take anything you say with a grain of seriousness. You cannot condemn human rights around the world and then turn a blind eye to what the United States government is now funding in Israel. People will laugh in your face. They will say to you, you're concerned about China, you're concerned about Russia, you're concerned about Iran. Well, why are you funding the starvation of children in Gaza right now?
So that's Senator Bernie Sanders. While this move did fail, it was the largest grouping of senators to vote against arming Israel. Akbar Shahid Ahmed, if you can talk about the significance of this and the latest piece you did on what happened in the White House and how they were threatening these senators, your exclusive White House says Democrats who oppose weapons to Israel are aiding Hamas.
Absolutely, Amy. And I'll just start by noting that what Ambassador Bania and Senator Sanders said that really speaks to the salience of this issue, right, and why it's not going away, something that the Biden administration has failed to grapple with. In their thinking, they think, well, people will get over this like they've gotten over foreign policy slights and missteps by the U.S. before. I think this is a fundamentally different issue. And what the Biden administration tried to do to kind of not just tackle and continue support for Israel, but to reject scrutiny and kind of threaten senators was really striking yesterday. So the exclusive I got that you were talking about was a document from the White House that they prepared and sent to Capitol Hill on Tuesday, 24 hours before the vote, where essentially they said, if you vote against weapons for Israel, you as United States senators are supporting Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. Now, that's the kind of accusation and rhetoric that observers say is reminiscent of the Bush administration, right? You're with us or you're against us. And that's the kind of thinking with which the Biden administration continues to approach critics of their policy, despite the really clear consequences of their policy and the fact that they're on their way out, right? They are not the future of the Democratic Party. It is now not just on Senator Sanders, but really on those who remain in the Senate, on Democrats kind of up and down the country, to craft a different legacy, given that there is popular dissatisfaction. And what I heard in terms of the White House document and talking points that they were pushing privately to senators was that this fueled just deep kind of resentment among senators who heard it. And folks were saying, look, the White House won't even put their name on these arguments while they're calling us kind of terrorist sympathizers, which is a huge claim about U.S. lawmakers. Simultaneously, Amy, the context of this is that hardline pro-Israel forces, chief among them AIPAC, which is the biggest pro-Israel lobby in the country, were also pushing against this vote. We're also telling senators, if you vote with Sanders, we're going to come after you. We see this as a betrayal of Israel, a close United States partner. So you saw the Biden administration working hand in glove with forces that are not just ardently pro-Israel, but have been against Democrats, often against Biden, against President Barack Obama, but that's where they've aligned themselves politically. The fact that after all of that, you still had close to a fifth of members of the U.S. Senate stand up and vote against weapons for Israel at a time of war, at a time when AIPAC and pro-Israel forces have indicated their political strength yet again, that's huge. This is historic and symbolic. And while I think anti-war advocates were to a degree disappointed, they had wanted to get at least half of Senate Democrats, the amount of intense pressure that you saw from the Biden administration to try to suppress this vote, including up to sending Secretary of State Tony Blinken to Capitol Hill yesterday, that shows you they were up against a lot, and they still managed to get 19 senators, which was quite a momentous showing.
Akbar Shahed Ahmed, we want to thank you so much for being with us, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. We'll link to your newest piece, which is an exclusive. White House says Democrats who oppose weapons to Israel are aiding Hamas. Coming up, we get the latest from here at the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, as calls mount for wealthy polluting nations to pay more for their role in causing the climate crisis. The People's Plenary has just gotten out. We are right next to it. The hundreds of people who are making their way out have taped their mouths with the words "pay up" written across the tape. We'll be back in a minute. The Riddle by Mizu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I am Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. In a room behind us, a people's plenary is underway called Pay Up, Stand Up, Finance Climate Action, Not Genocide, where civil society just unfurled the names of Palestinians who've been killed and prayed for the dead. As the summit is set to wrap Friday for a climate finance deal, a new draft of a possible deal has been submitted and is being condemned by both rich and poor countries. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke here earlier today.
From now on, what matters is not what was the initial position of each party. What now matters is how to find a compromise that allows for an ambitious result in relation to the new global goal, because finance is in the center of this COP, but at the same time to take into account the concerns of all other countries in relation to the different aspects that are relevant for the future of our battle against climate change.
That's the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Among the major issues is the absence of a firm number in the draft text on how much rich countries will pay. Poorer nations bearing the brunt of the climate crisis say at least $1.3 trillion a year is needed. For more, we're joined here in Baku by two guests. Harjit Singh is the Global Engagement Director with the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. He's co-founder of Satat Sampada, a social impact organization. He's based in New Delhi, India. We are also joined by Fiona Harvey. She is the longtime environment editor at The Guardian, and it's not easy to pin her down for an interview. So we're thrilled you're here with us right now. There is a lot of noise in the background. The People's Plenary has just gotten out. We hear them talking, although many have put tape over their mouths that say pay up. We'll speak to some of them in a little while. But Fiona, it's really hard to navigate through everything that happens at these UN climate summits, maybe partly purposely so people can't follow. But today the issue is finance. And if you in lay terms can break it down for us, what exactly was the statement that was released this morning? What document was released? And what has been the response of the wealthy nations and the poorer nations?
So we're here to negotiate a global settlement on climate finance, which is all about getting the funds that the poor world needs in order to cut greenhouse gas emissions, shift to a low-carbon economy, and adapt to the impacts of extreme weather driven by the climate crisis. This is incredibly important. This is the future of these countries depends on getting this finance. And what they're demanding is about $1 trillion a year. Now, that sounds like a lot of money. It's actually not a great deal of money when you put it in context. It's about 1% of the global economy. And it's really a sum of money that is eminently findable. You know, we already spend, as a world, we spend about $3 trillion a year on energy, about two-thirds of it on clean energy, a third on fossil fuels. So $1 trillion a year may sound like a lot, but it's actually doable. What's happened today is that we've got a draft text of what should become an agreement to get this money from the rich to the poor. Unfortunately, this draft text is not great. It doesn't actually have the key numbers in there. And it also, it's got various kind of clauses and things in there that a lot of people are unhappy with. Everyone seems to be unhappy with this text. It's not just developed or developing countries. It's pretty much everyone. I think we need to kind of view it as maybe a first attempt by the presidency, because they're going to come up with another later today, maybe tomorrow morning, effectively, whereas hopefully some of these problems are resolved and hopefully we get some of the key numbers in there.
Could you explain, even within that, Fiona, the question of finance? How much of that finance, in terms of the negotiations so far, are being considered loans or grants?
Okay, so if you look at the $1 trillion a year, we need to get some of that money should come from directly from developed countries, but a lot of that money is going to come indirectly in other ways, and some of it will probably need to come from the private sector. Now that's controversial for some countries. There are some developing countries who say we don't want the money to come from the private sector, but in effect, that's really going to be necessary to get to the $1 trillion mark, because developed countries who are here are not going to agree to hand over $1 trillion a year among them. That's not going to happen. So what developed countries are likely to agree is probably something like maybe a tripling of the current amount of climate finance, which is $100 billion. So that could be something like $300 billion a year. And some of that would come directly from developed countries. Some of it would come through multilateral development banks. And then the rest of the money, some of it would come from the private sector, and some of it could come from new sources of finance, like new taxes on fossil fuels, wealth taxes, taxes on frequent flying, and so on. There are lots of potential sources of money out there that really haven't been tapped yet.
And could you talk about, because the COP presidency has also come under criticism for not doing enough to make sure that an agreement was reached. And minimally, as you said, the draft agreement that's been released doesn't even have a number, much less a good one or a bad one. What role does the COP presidency play in enabling this negotiation and making sure some kind of agreement is reached?
Well, we are now at a crunch moment. This is the absolute test of this COP presidency. Is this going to be a successful COP or not? It's in the hands of the presidency now. And so the presidency has got to take this text, which has been slammed and shot down by pretty much everyone, go away, start again, and come up with a text that works. So hopefully now what they're doing is in the back rooms of this conference, engaging in shuttle diplomacy, talking to all of the parties, getting their concerns, getting their feelings, and, you know, pushing and being firm with people where necessary. What they will want to see is a good number from developed countries. What developed countries want to see is also a broadening of the contributor base, because at the moment you have a lot of countries who have big economies and big greenhouse gas emissions, but they don't contribute to climate finance. So that's countries like China, for instance, second biggest economy in the world, first biggest emitter by a really long way, and they don't actually do climate finance in the same way that developed countries do. They do some south-south cooperation, but it's very hard to judge. So if China were able to kind of flesh that out a bit more, that might work. There are also a lot of countries who are making a great deal of money from fossil fuels, and they don't pay into climate finance. Talking about Saudi Arabia here, talking about Qatar and United Arab Emirates, there are countries like that, petrostates effectively, who make their money from selling stuff that creates the problem we're here to solve.
Speaking of which, when we're talking about petrostates, that's exactly where this UN COP, COP29, is taking place. It's taking place in Baku, Azerbaijan, leading petrostate, the first, I believe, oil-exporting country in the world. And I'm wondering about the significance of this. I mean, we, outside civil society, many climate justice activists and journalists have been arrested in the lead-up to the COP, who expose oil and gas deals and corruption, leading economists, six journalists with an independent media outlet. And you also have here Global Witness exposing, acting like they were an oil dealer, and calling up one of the heads of the COP presidency and saying, we'd like to make a deal with you. Before you leave us, Fiona, if you can talk about the significance. Last year it was in UAE a petrostate. The head of it was the head of the National Oil Company. And this year, the repression on the outside and the deals that are being made on the inside, the largest delegation is the delegation of oil lobbyists from around the world.
It's a really big issue at COPs, and the role of fossil fuel lobbyists here is terribly problematic. It's why some very prominent people have been calling here for reform of the COP process so that this can't happen. They want there to be more control over who's allowed to be the president of a COP so that it couldn't be necessarily an oil state in future unless that oil state really agrees to actually take action and to agree to phase out fossil fuels and set out a credible pathway towards that. If an oil state were to do that, then I'm sure they'd be welcomed by very many people. So, yes, it's a problem. On the other hand, the strength of this COP is that it is global. It's every country in the world comes here. Every country is entitled to have an equal say. And that's really, really important because it means that the poorest countries can come here and confront the richest countries who are causing the problem. So, you want to make this COP as open as possible. And to some extent, that means you have to make it open to petrostates, problematic though that is. So that's a problem that everyone here is still wrestling with.
I guess the question is, if only it was as open to civil society. Fiona, we want to thank you for being with us. We have to take another break, and then we're going to be joined by a leading Indian climate justice activist, Fiona Harvey, longtime environment editor at The Guardian newspaper. Harjit Singh will be joining us as he sits right here. There is a lot happening. People's plenary just opened up. Many people gathering around, even where we are. And we're going to talk to some of the activists who just came out of that plenary. Stay with us. By the Azerbaijani musician Farhana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Joined for more on the latest by Harjit Singh, Global Engagement Director with the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty, co-founder of Satat Sampada, Social Impact Group. He's from New Delhi, India. How much effect can you have here, Harjit? You've been to many of these COPs. They are getting outside, in civil society, more and more repressive. Last year in the UAE, here, both from outside the pressure of the state, but even inside, we have many people here, we're going to talk to them in a few minutes, who have been wearing tape over their mouths that say pay up. Your response to what's being released at this point and what you want to see happen. You're wearing your lanyard says pay up $5 trillion.
That's exactly what we need. And this is what civil society movement has been demanding, because that's the money rich countries owe to developing countries for all the injustices that they have done to people around the world, particularly in the developing world. And you look at the climate crisis that we are facing. And I must say, this is to me, the most important COP where finance has to be delivered. Because we got Paris Agreement, the reality is that developing countries have put some ambitious plans on the table, be it transitioning away from fossil fuels or protecting their people from climate impacts. But there is no money available. And can you imagine that after spending 3 years to agree on a new climate finance goal, we have had 14 meetings, several ministerials, and yet we have not seen any number coming from rich countries, and we have already spent 11 days here. At the penultimate day, rich countries are not revealing what commitment they are making to provide to this new climate finance goal, which is going to replace the $100 billion, which was quite a sham because what they provided was largely loans. So nothing is going to move if we do not get an ambitious new climate finance goal, which must be in trillions of dollars annually.
So, Harjeet, I want to ask you, I mean, you're the head of this, the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty and a global engagement director for this treaty. What about the agreement that was reached last year at COP28 in Dubai, where commitments were made, or at least there was phrasing, to transition away from fossil fuels? There's been an enormous amount of opposition to that in this year's meeting, including from countries like Saudi Arabia and even Bolivia. So where do those negotiations stand?
I mean, what happened at COP28, and we all were there, it was historic. It wasn't perfect, but for the first time after 30 years, we could manage to get fossil fuels in a climate agreement and agreeing to transition away from fossil fuels. Of course, it was not perfect because we had several what we call dangerous distractions or false solutions in the form of offsets and removals, and even talking about nuclear, that wasn't perfect. But at the same time, that was a step forward. And here we have been struggling to get that on the agenda. The reality is that developed countries are trying to pose themselves as climate leaders. They want a conversation on that, but back home, they are expanding fossil fuels. We all know countries like the US, UK, Norway, Canada, and Australia are going to be responsible for fossil fuel expansion between now and 2050. That's more than 50% of the plans that they have put forward. That's the reality. And the hypocrisy is they want a discussion on it, but they don't want to act upon it back home. And without providing any finance, they want developing countries like Colombia or Timor-Leste to move away from it. So the core of the issue remains finance. Unless money is put on the table, the transitioning away from fossil fuels is not going to be a reality in developing countries.
And so if you could explain already how much of, I mean, you know, the Global South countries carry an enormous amount of debt. How much debt has been accumulated by developing countries or Global South countries that is through climate financing already?
Well, the
because they're loans and not
exactly
grants, as you
the
said.
Number that rich countries claim to provide this time is about $112 billion, and their own admission is that 69% of that is loans. So imagine that they are actually increasing the loans on developing countries, adding to the debt crisis that they are already facing. And even now, the conversation is that most of the money that's going to be provided as part of the new climate finance goal is going to be either loans or investments. Very little money is being talked about in the form of grants, and that's the question developing countries are asking. India has put forth a number that at least $600 billion annually must be in the form of grants. And I must underline the point that when it comes to adaptation, which means preparing for climate impacts or recovering from disasters, you cannot expect poor communities and countries to borrow money, because that's an additional cost that they have to pay. And when we talk about loss and damage, I had a house, I lost it, and then you're asking me to take a loan for that.
So let me ask you something. The Biden administration is going out. President Trump has been reelected. He wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And you have many people saying, why should we have anything to do with any international organization? And why should the U.S. pay for you or anyone here, their countries, for their climate problems?
Because the U.S. has caused the problem in the first place. U.S. is responsible for one quarter of global greenhouse gas emissions cumulatively. And it has benefited most from that fossil fuel-based industrialization. And people in the country are enjoying the fruits of that. So U.S. as a country is liable to pay, and rather the climate debt that they owe to developing countries. It's their responsibility, it's their obligation, and another quarter must come from European Union. That's the reality. So U.S. has to own up the responsibility and pay climate finance to developing countries for mitigation, adaptation, and dealing with loss and damage.
Harjeet, very quickly, you live in Delhi, which is now today the most polluted country, a city in the world. Describe conditions there and why the situation is so bad that schools have been closed and the chief minister has called an emergency, a medical emergency.
I mean, it is an emergency, but I would say it's our own creation. It's the same development model that India has adopted, which the West has been promoting all over the world. And it's the same fossil fuel-based development. There's a lot of commonality between what's happening in Delhi right now because of the high vehicular pollution, because of the industrial use of fossil fuels, and we are stuck with that system. And the AQI is now more than 500. It's a national emergency. My own daughter is studying from home because she's not allowed to go to school. Schools are shut down. And governments need to act. And I think the common part is, how do we move away from fossil fuels, which has caused the climate crisis, which is responsible for the pollution, and that environmental degradation that's happening because of this model has to be questioned. So while pollution remains a local issue, but at the heart of it is the fossil fuel-based development, which we must move away from.
Harjeet Singh is with us. He was with the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Coalition. We are also joined by other members of civil society from around the world. I'm going to get up right now. They have just come from across this broad room from the Caspian Plenary Hall, where they held a people summit. One of the co-chairs of that summit, which is called Pay Up, Stand Up, Finance Climate Action, Not Genocide, where civil society unfurled the names of Palestinians who've been killed and prayed for the dead. We're joined right now by co-chair. The co-chair is Liddy Nakpal, who is a longtime Filipina climate activist and coordinator with the Asia People Summit on Debt and Development and the global campaign to demand climate justice. Liddy, it's so great to have you with us today. If you can talk about what the point of this plenary was, hundreds of people packed in.
Well, we wanted first to feel our power of solidarity together. So it was a really great opportunity for us to come together in big numbers, such as we've not had in this COP because of the whole layout and the rules. So this was a great celebration of our power together.
I think you should explain more. What is the issue here? Why are there so many silent protests? And explain the rules where you cannot mention a country name. You can't even say where you're from.
Yes, that is one of the rules of the security and the UNFCCC Secretariat. In order to protect, they say, the dignity and to protect respect for the different countries and governments of the country. So we're not allowed to mention governments. There is a policy that we can't name and shame, but apparently that also applies to we can't praise particular governments. So we just can't name any government and we can't even say where we're from. But we have been doing our best to use this space to raise our voices on the critical issues that are being discussed here that affects our lives. And one of that is the genocide that's happening in this world. It's very much a climate issue, as it is an issue of justice, and also the issue of climate finance, which is supposed to be part of the reparations for the climate debt that is owed to our people in the global south.
We're also joined by Jenna Rashid. Jenna Rashid is a climate advocate, a Palestinian based in London. In Lebanon. You are wearing a keffiyeh. Yeah. Inside, it was very moving at the beginning of this session, where the names of hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinians and Lebanese were put on sheets and people unfurled them. Talk about why you're here today and what your message is.
Like, I'm here today, first of all, to amplify the voices of my people in Palestine and Lebanon to talk about the genocides that are happening, because we can't be here talking about climate justice without mentioning the injustices around the world, because it's also linked with the environment. It's also linked with the ecocides that is happening. Because of the genocide that is currently happening in both Lebanon and Palestine, the soil are being contaminated because of the bombing. The sea is being contaminated also because of the bombing. So we can't be like, we can't have this hypocrisy in the world and be here talking about just transition and climate justice without mentioning these injustices. And we are here as collective Palestinians. There are a collective Palestinian that came up with a campaign called Global Energy Embargo for Palestine, where they are calling countries such as Brazil, South Africa, and Turkey, these countries that claim to support Palestinians, but on the other hand, they are fueling genocide and they are making the fuels come out from their countries to the occupation. So yeah, we are here demanding to stop fueling genocide, demanding to stop the transportation of the fuel from these countries to the occupation.
We're also joined by another climate activist. We're joined right now by Lina Issa, who is a climate justice advocate from Sudan. If you can talk about why you're here today, what you're trying to accomplish and what Sudan is facing.
I'm basically here to speak about Sudan because no one here talking about Sudan. We are so neglected. Families are separated. Women got raped, and a lot of children lose their lives according to nothing, literally. And the media is not covering us. No one is speaking about us. There's a genocide happening in there. And my country are blooding. And even, like, every region in Sudan are neglected, blooding, and also the media are blind from us because no one really care about us. I don't know why. Is it because we are black people, but black people life matter? And I'm here today to speak up about Sudan, to speak about the women, children, men, the families, all the families that are separated now. We need to stop this war. We need to defund this genocide right now. A lot of countries are supporting this genocide, but no one another is supporting the Sudanese themselves. Like, there's no safety, security, and all of this. And we are all here calling, there's no one here to, we are here not, to leave anyone behind, but unfortunately, Sudanese people are behind the table, and we are depending, and no one literally talking about us.
Lina, I want to thank you so much for standing here and speaking up for your country, for your people. Lina Issa is a climate justice advocate from Sudan. And I want to thank Lydia Nakpil, longtime climate activist and co-chair of the People's Plenary that just take place. She is a Filipina climate activist. And I want to thank Jana Rashid, a climate advocate, Palestinian based in Lebanon. We thank you all for being with us as we wrap up our show today. We only have a few seconds. We want to also thank Harjeet Singh, who came to this summit from New Delhi, India. Thousands of people have gathered. I think it's something like 77,000 people are registered for this UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Next year, it will take place in Brazil, in the rainforest right on the edge. Well, we want to thank the amazing team of people who helped us today. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkty, Nagusra Messiah-Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.